a lot of people don't see people who have criminal records or are incarcerated as human beings. And I can't emphasize enough how wrong that is. I mean, everyone who is incarcerated has their own life story, and they are a person who has constitutional rights, but also just, you know, personalities. And it blows my mind the way that we as a society speak about incarcerated people as criminals and drug addicts and whatever. And at the end of the day, when I look at my clients and I look at my loved ones and I looked at people that I know who are incarcerated, they're just other people. And so I think if you want to do this work, if you want to be a civil rights lawyer, that is the first and foremost mentality that you have to have.
Welcome back to Cases for Causes, hosted by OBO Interactive. I'm Michael Turner, and today I am joined by Sam Harton of Romanucci & Blandin in Chicago. Sam is a prominent civil rights attorney, primarily representing victims of police and jail misconduct. While passionately pursuing justice for her clients, Sam's ultimate goal is achieving broader change in the way our society thinks about carceral systems and treats people who have been impacted by the criminal punishment industry. Today, Sam joins me to discuss the ins and outs of police and jail misconduct cases, sharing insights into the complex legal process, cases she's worked on, and much more. Well, Sam, hello. Thank you for taking the time to join the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to our discussion about police and jail misconduct cases. I think it's a critically important topic, and I think it's something people think they understand, but there's so many nuances and complexities, and I'm really looking forward to your insight. With that, let's jump into it. I think a good starting point would be for you to define what is police and jail misconduct for our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, obviously a very, very broad question. My work primarily focuses on correctional settings, misconduct by correctional officers or medical providers inside of prisons and jails. But I also do some police misconduct. So that would be more what you're thinking of, you know, patrol officers, people that you're interacting with out on the street. I think there's a few different types of misconduct that you can allege against a government official when you're talking about police and jail misconduct. One of the areas is just uses of force. So if a police officer discharges his firearm at you, if a correctional officer, for example, I have one case where a correctional officer pushed our client's knee into a hot pipe and burned his leg. So the uses of force are sort of like what we classically think of problems with police and correctional misconduct. There's also some other types of failure to provide medical care. If you are in a prison or jail, they are responsible for providing you with your basic necessities, including medical care. And so that includes both physical and medical care. For example, I have a client whose leg was amputated due to an infection inside of a prison facility. It also includes mental health care, which we can definitely talk about later. It's a big, big part of my practice are people who have committed suicide inside of jails or prisons. And so correctional officers and mental health providers are required to provide a basic level of mental health care to the people inside of their facilities constitutionally. And so when we talk about police misconduct, correctional officer misconduct, we're typically talking about violations of federal law, the Constitution. So Fourth Amendment would govern excessive force by a police officer. The Eighth Amendment would govern cruel and unusual punishment inside of a prison facility. The 14th Amendment covers due process. So if you haven't been convicted of a crime yet, but you're being held in a jail, you know, you have due process rights to not be deprived of your life, for example, prior to getting your day in court. So those are the legal bases. You can also go after municipalities based on state law if you believe that you've been wronged. That can get a little bit complicated. But yeah, those are the basics, I think.
Yeah, and you definitely covered some that I think kind of maybe fly under the radar a little bit or aren't as well documented when these bigger stories hit the media, things like, you know, the standard of medical care and whatnot as well. Are there any other types that maybe don't make the headlines that come to mind?
Let me think. I think conditions of confinement is one. It's, you know, one thing that I think will be a common theme in my answers today is that most of the issues that we are alleging that cause our clients harm are not because of one bad apple. A lot of people, because I am a civil rights lawyer, assume that I don't like police officers, that I don't like correctional officers. And, you know, generally the correctional officers and the police officers that I've interacted with in my daily life, I don't see as much of a problem with them as individuals. My typical concerns regarding the criminal punishment system are systemic. The way that we punish poverty, the way that we treat people who have not followed every single rule and have been caught not following every single rule of our society. And so conditions of confinement is one of the allegations that we allege when we see these really systemic issues. So for example, we have a case in New Orleans or a suburb of New Orleans where we have alleged that our clients were subject to unconstitutional conditions while waiting for their trial. They're not convicted criminals. They are waiting for trial and they were put in holding cells for weeks at a time, no bed to sleep on, sleeping on the floor, sleeping in other people's feces, urine, vomit, you know, just really horrific stuff. And so that is the kind of thing that you can't find one officer, right, who messed up and who to blame. These are systemic issues within the facility. And I think that that's going to be a common theme when I talk about why I do this work and why this work is important.
I mean, that's super interesting because a lot of probably officers are just following orders too. So it becomes a larger problem. So that was really insightful.
Well, I just wanted to add based on that, you know, they're following orders. Not just that, first of all, following orders, correctional systems are paramilitary systems, which means that there's a very strict chain of command. There's, you know, majors, lieutenants, captains that are in charge of their sergeants and their officers. Very strict chain of command that they have to follow. So yes, they are following orders. And even more importantly, they're following a culture. And so when I depose correctional officers, I often find them to be very likable people. I often find them to be very sympathetic people who feel bad about what they did. And a lot of times, not all the time, but a lot of times they're operating within a broader culture that and a broader system that is failing to implement important policies, failing to train, things like that, that are very concerning as far as like, okay, how do we fix these problems? Because I just really deeply believe it's not just getting rid of one or two bad guys. It's got to be a creative and thoughtful reimagination of how we implement corrective action to people who have not followed whatever rules society has deemed that they need to follow.
For those who are incarcerated or who are going through something like this, how do they typically reach you? How do they typically get in contact with a lawyer and start the process? I would imagine it's difficult.
Our firm, you know, we're very lucky that we are well known for doing civil rights firms and civil rights cases. And so usually we get contacted by family members directly who have lost a loved one or have experienced violence or failure to provide medical care inside of jails themselves. We often get referred cases by other attorneys doing this work or attorneys who do criminal work and are representing someone in their criminal case. And they say, hey, I think my client might have a claim here. Would you mind looking into the civil side of it, which I would do. So I think that's typically how they come to us with wrongful death cases, which are primarily what I focus on, are a little trickier because you have to make sure that you've got the right person contacting you, if it can't just be, you know, a friend that calls you and wants you to represent them to be the administrator of their estate, that's not going to work. You have to make sure that you represent the right people in a wrongful death action. So, but typically just, you know, calling lawyers who do civil rights work is the way to pursue a claim for violation of your civil rights.
Got it. I was going to ask actually if there's collaboration with, you know, their defense attorney, but.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And not to get too technical, but these cases I would imagine are difficult and they're much different than, you know, standard personal injury cases. Can you maybe explain a little bit about how it works for maybe potential other attorneys listening or even potential claimants?
Yeah, this is going to be a long answer. So what you will notice about civil rights lawyers is that they tend to specialize in civil rights because it is a very technical area of the law. And there's a lot of legal issues that only come up in the civil rights context that you don't have to worry about if you are pursuing a negligence claim for a premises liability or medical malpractice or anything like that. And so there's three main things that come to mind when I think about the differences in litigating these cases. The first would be there is no respondeat superior in a Section 1983 claim. Section 1983 is the law that Congress passed that provides a cause of action for you to sue a government official for violation of civil rights. So the Constitution provides, okay, the police can't use unreasonable force against you, can't use excessive force against you. But Section 1983 provides the remedy that, okay, if that happens, if there is a violation of my Fourth Amendment right, then I can go to court and I can sue for damages. Section 1983, based on some Supreme Court precedent, this one case called Monell, provides that there is no respondeat superior for Section 1983 claims, which means that you, when you sue for medical malpractice, you sue the doctor, and then the hospital will typically be liable under respondeat superior because they employed the doctor and the doctor was acting within his scope of employment. That's not a thing in civil rights. That is not a thing. We have to. So there's two ways to access the deep pocket, which would be the government official. Obviously, your average correctional officer is not going to have a lot of money to compensate your client for the harm. So you need to reach the deep pocket in another way. Typically, that would be respondeat superior, but that's not an option for civil rights Section 1983 claims. So you either need to prove that the municipality itself caused the harm. And they were the moving force behind the constitutional violation. And that can be very difficult. You have to allege some sort of theory and prove eventually some sort of theory of they had this custom and practice of not training officers on reasonable uses of force. They didn't have a policy that made sure that mental health providers were screening for suicide risk. And so because they didn't have that policy, your client was able to commit suicide on the premises. That can be very, very hard to prove. The second way that you can access the deep pocket, absent this respondeat superior, is indemnification. So it's very important for civil rights lawyers to understand what the indemnification policy is for whatever government official and government entity you're suing. So most states, I believe, I know Illinois indemnifies its state employees for to an extent. And so that means that if you sue a correctional officer who works for the Illinois Department of Corrections and you recover against that correctional officer, the state of Illinois has to pay. With municipalities, it might be a little bit different. It might be by contract that they are indemnified. It just sort of depends on your jurisdiction. And so that's one of the first things you should be looking into in discovery is how am I gonna get my client paid? And I'm not gonna get an empty judgment. Second big difference between civil rights cases and, you know, garden variety personal injury cases is qualified immunity. Qualified immunity is a judge-made doctrine that says that it's a two-prong analysis where at summary judgment, usually the judge gets to decide, A, was this use of force objectively unreasonable? And B, was it clearly established at the time of the violation? The first prong is not as much of a hurdle. It's usually just part of proving your elements anyway. So it's not so much a big deal, except that the judge gets to decide it as opposed to a jury. But the second prong that can really, really cause problems and make these cases really, really, really hard is the clearly established prong, because a lot of times what you have to do to prove your case, even if you think that this is slam dunk, this is obviously a violation, you have to find a case in your jurisdiction where the facts are analogous enough to what your client experienced so that the officer was put on notice that this particular act would be unconstitutional. And I think when I describe it in a vacuum that way, it doesn't sound that outlandish. It sounds actually maybe to a lot of people like a reasonable restriction on a reasonable backstop to too much litigation against police officers. They have a hard job or whatever, you know, that's sort of the policy behind it. But it leads to some really, really, really absurd results where you've got cases where it's just really outlandish conduct by a police officer or a correctional officer, and you don't even get to a jury because you can't find a case that's close enough to the facts here. And I mean, we could do a whole episode on qualified immunity, so I won't talk about it much longer. All I will say is that if you are doing civil rights cases, one of the first things you should be doing when you get the case, when you get intake, is research the case law in your jurisdiction, find the closest cases that you can find to your set of facts, and make sure qualified immunity will not apply and preclude you from getting to a jury. Because I can't tell you the amount of times I've gotten an intake and I've been like, oh, this is a great case. This is clearly a problem. And then I've looked at the case law and seen, oh, wow, they granted qualified immunity on a very similar set of facts 3 years ago. And that can be a real problem where you can't just be like, oh, they clearly committed some sort of misconduct. No, you need to make sure the qualified immunity will not apply before you sign the case. The third thing that I think is important to understand when you're doing civil rights cases is the 11th Amendment. It's not the sexiest amendment. It is the amendment that ensures individuals cannot sue their state. So I cannot sue the state of Illinois for violating my civil rights. I can, for damages at least. And so I have to sue the correctional officer instead of the state itself. Some states have waivers of sovereign immunity that change the extent to which you can sue the state. But that is very important if you've got a case where you've got someone in a state-run correctional facility, like the Department of Corrections here in Illinois. You need to look at what your sovereign immunity waiver is. It's usually going to be the Tort Claims Act in your state. It's going to explain to you to what extent you can sue the state, where, what the damages caps are. That's going to be very important to understand as far as pulling from whatever pocket that you can.
First of all, incredible answer. Really outlined it very clearly for us. I have a question kind of on a tangent and about myself personally. Is before I worked for Obo, I actually worked for a startup company that provided body cameras to police officers. So my question is, how much in recent years has body camera footage played a role in helping with your case, or maybe in some cases not helping?
In the corrections context, not at all. We rarely have. I don't think I've ever had a body cam in a prison or in jail. Sometimes there is surveillance, like a camera in the corner of the dorm or whatever, and that can be helpful. Yeah. Body cam is very interesting. I have two cases where the jurisdiction had body cams. The police was wearing a body cam, and we have body cam footage of some stuff after the incident, before the incident, but we don't have it during the incident. I have one case where my client was shot and killed by the police, or not my client, but my client's husband was shot and killed by the police. And it's one of those cases where there were quite a few lay witnesses there. There are very differing accounts on what happened based on what the officer says and what the people at the scene said. And we don't have body cam footage. And so body cam footage would be really, really, really helpful in just understanding what happened, but we don't have it. And so, and that officer was wearing a body cam, and he also had a dash cam on his car, and neither captured the incident. I don't know why. We have not discovered why. And it's very, I'm finding that it's less useful than I was hoping, because so often it just doesn't capture what happened. But there are other cases. You know, our firm represents the family of Tyree Nichols. There was video in that case that was broadcast across the country. Same with George Floyd. So obviously video, when it happens, is invaluable. It can prove your case, or it can prove the officer's case. It just depends. But it has to be on. And a lot of times it's not. I'm really, that's been one of the more shocking things to me in working with some of these police cases, is how off, like, I think a lot of people assume body cam is ubiquitous now, and it's just not.
It was definitely interesting living in that world for a little, because there are supposed to be automatic, you know, triggers to turn on the camera, right? If you draw your gun, if you go to code 3 with your lights. So I would hope that it's trending toward helping more than, you know, not even being used. But I was curious based on, you know, my background.
Right. Yeah. I know that there are some jurisdictions where the body cam is triggered as soon as you turn on your blue lights. Yeah. But what's hard about that is not every, I think what a lot of people don't understand about policing is that a lot of it is not responding to an emergency. And a lot of times jurisdictions only activate their blue lights or their sirens or whatever might trigger their body cam if they're responding to an emergency. A lot of times they're just called to check on a noise disturbance or do a wellness check or something like that. And in that case, they might not turn on their blue lights. They might not turn on their sirens, and they might not turn on their body cam, because they're just there. They're just checking up. They're just making sure everything's all good. And then things escalate, and we don't have the evidence that we need to show what really happened.
Definitely an interesting world to live in. And, you know, we always talked about it as protection for them, right? But obviously there's so many other potential benefits of wearing them.
Right.
So let's talk about you next. How did you choose to focus on police and jail misconduct? Of all the, you know, niches and out there, and I guess maybe a better phrasing would be, how did you choose to focus on civil rights?
So I went to The Ohio State University because I wanted to do public interest work. I had been working at a newspaper company in Madison, Wisconsin, and I just kind of realized publishing wasn't really scratching the itch of purposeful work that I wanted to do. And so I started volunteering at a legal aid organization in Madison. And I realized that I really liked some of this work. And so I applied to law school. I went to Ohio State. And when I got there, I wasn't sure really what I wanted to do. I just knew I wanted to do public interest. And so I tried a bunch of different things. I did some housing work. That wasn't a great fit. I did some reproductive rights work. I did some immigration work. And then my 2L year, I got an opportunity to work for the Illinois Prison Project, writing some clemency petitions and doing some other stuff, trying to get people out of prison. And I highly recommend, if you are interested in this work, if you really care about the rights of incarcerated people, that you check out the Illinois Prison Project. They're a really great organization. But that experience really sort of showed me this might be a really good fit. I think what it showed me was you can do work helping people who are impacted by the criminal punishment system and not just be like a criminal defense lawyer. There are other things that you can do. And it kind of opened me up to this world of incarcerated people's rights outside of just the criminal trial. And so I worked for them for a while. Then I went on to work for a sole practitioner doing civil rights work. But then my 3L year, another really formative experience was one of my dear friends in law school. Her husband was incarcerated, and right before he was up for parole, they, you know, quote unquote, found some drugs in his cell. And there were a lot of holes in their case, a lot of issues with their case that we were like, this can't be right. And so his trial was actually set for our 3L spring, our last semester of law school. And so my friend who was married to him, as well as another friend, we drove to Pennsylvania and we watched the trial. And we watched the prosecution put on their case. And again, there were a lot of problems. And we watched what I believe was a lot of correctional officers coming together to try to keep this guy incarcerated when he was about to get out. And it was a very eye-opening experience in the sense of seeing people that I really believed were not telling the truth, people who were public servants who I really believed were not being honest. And at the end, it was quite a short deliberation. I believe it was less than an hour, and our friend was acquitted. And it's still to this day, when I think about it, it's one of the most special moments of my life, was getting to watch him be acquitted. And he actually got paroled and he was able to come to my wedding. And it's just like a really a beautiful moment to share with my friend and her husband. And it really taught me two things. One was this, wow, they're really trying to keep this guy in prison for what? For what reason? It was so obvious that he didn't do this. There was so much evidence that he didn't do this. It was really incredible to try to understand why. Why are they wasting all this time and resource on prosecuting this when this case is so obvious? And then another thing is just like, the relationships that you build with people are so, so important. I mean, we all have really important relationships in our lives with loved ones and I think people don't appreciate the extent to which incarcerated people are people who have that too. Like, a lot of people don't see people who have criminal records or are incarcerated as human beings. And I can't emphasize enough how wrong that is. I mean, everyone who is incarcerated has their own life story, and they are a person who has constitutional rights, but also just, you know, personalities. And it blows my mind the way that we as a society speak about incarcerated people as criminals and drug addicts and whatever. And at the end of the day, when I look at my clients and I look at my loved ones and I looked at people that I know who are incarcerated, they're just other people. And so I think if you want to do this work, if you want to be a civil rights lawyer, that is the first and foremost mentality that you have to have. You have to see your clients as human beings and not as whatever the defense wants to characterize them as, which is going to be criminals, going to be these awful, awful, awful people. And that's not true. And so I think building relationships with people who are impacted by the criminal punishment system. Maybe if you have been personally impacted by the criminal punishment system, I think that's a really important perspective to bring to the work.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I'm glad to hear he was acquitted and the result was a positive one. Really fascinating, and definitely going to check out the Illinois Prison Project. I would imagine there's other similar organizations maybe out here in California too, but really good. You and your firm, you've worked on some significant cases. Is there one particular case, or even one maybe that's going on now, that you want to share about that maybe someone hears and thinks, you know, that happened to my loved one? Maybe it reaches the right ears.
I think all my cases are important. I think that a lot of the stories that my clients have to tell are very important. But there's one in particular that I think I'd like to share that I think covers the thing that I just talked about, which is the humanity of people who are subject to the correctional system, as well as some of the systemic issues that we've talked about. So I have a case where my client's daughter, she was 16. She had, for the past few years, had been picked up by the police and put into the juvenile detention facilities for issues related to mental health, for issues related to substance use. And you know, she was a kid who was struggling with some stuff. And the way that our society is set up is that she goes into the criminal punishment system in order to fix those problems. That's what we, and we can debate the efficacy of that all day, but that is, like it or not, that is what our society has decided is the right way to handle those issues. And so that's what happened to her. She was in and out of the juvenile detention facility a few times. And then in August of 2022, she runs away. And she's missing. And a few days later, I think it was 10 days later, the police find her and they pick her up. And when they pick her up, she swallows all the pills that she has on her. And they take her to the juvenile detention facility. They call the parents and they say, "We've got your daughter, found her." And the parents breathe a sigh of relief. Like, she's safe. Like, she found her. She's safe. She's going to get help. When she's booked into the detention facility, she tells the intake officer, the person who's doing her booking, "I swallowed a bunch of pills right before I got here." And so she was sent to a cell. And in that cell, she was alone for several hours. And over those several hours, she overdosed. And the overdose itself lasted several hours. It lasted a long time. She eventually passed away. She died a very, very painful death that lasted a very long time. And she was not taken to the hospital until after she was unconscious. She was not given any aid until after she was unconscious. And so I think that this case, I think it says a lot about the broader failures of the correctional industry that we have, which is that this girl, she had gone to the detention facility multiple times for help, and it failed her over and over again until her last visit, where it was the ultimate failure and she died. And now a family doesn't have their daughter when all she needed was to go to the hospital. And they knew from the beginning that she had just swallowed a bunch of pills and likely needed to go to the hospital. The second thing that I think that this case really teaches us is, again, what I was talking about earlier, is Lexi was really loved. The community has rallied around her, and people have written letters of support to the judge. This case is actually being prosecuted criminally. The officers who failed to help her is actually being prosecuted criminally. And people in the community have sent letters of support explaining how loved Lexi was. They've held vigils. They've really rallied around the family. And then this past May was actually when Lexi would have graduated high school. And they had a seat for her and they graduated her. And it makes me really kind of crazy when I talk to people about my work. And a lot of people are, you know, "Oh, that's so interesting. That's so great." But a lot of people are like, "Oh, like, so, you know," and they want to get into a debate about, you know, corrections or police or whatever. And, you know, "Oh, well, are we supposed to spend all our money and taxes on criminals and blah, blah, blah?" And I just, that really bothers me when I think about Lexi and I think about a lot of my other clients, is these are human beings who need help, who are corrections is a housing. It is a provider of housing and other basic needs. And when someone goes into one of those facilities, they are responsible. The correctional officers and the medical professionals are responsible for that person and that person's safety. And I emphasize they are responsible for that person's safety, not just this criminal that it can just be discarded because, oh, they do drugs or they have mental health issues or they did some sort of property crime. No, like these are people. And so I think that Alexi, the way that the community has really supported the family of Alexis has been, it's been really beautiful. And it's been really telling of how these are human beings who deserve, who are worth something, and their lives are worth something.
Yeah. It's terribly sad. I mean, but it is amazing to hear the community rallying that you just described. And yeah, those debates are just awful and horrendous. I can't stand them either. But hearing the way you described that was really beautiful. So thank you for, you know, taking on cases like this. Can I ask, you know, maybe where this is? Is it still a case people can follow along with? Is it still going on?
Yeah, the case is, we have not filed our lawsuit yet. We will be filing it soon. We've waited a little bit to see how the criminal prosecution pans out, but it will be filed very soon. There has been some news coverage on it. I think the community is really interested, and I think that it's just a huge injustice, and I think there will be more to come for sure. And I'm really looking forward to fighting on behalf of the family because they deserve justice.
Well, Sam, I'd really like to thank you again for taking the time to join the podcast today. This was a super insightful episode. So for anyone looking to get in touch with you, whether it's an attorney, whether it's somebody looking to pursue a claim, what's the best way they can do that?
You can go on our website, rblaw.net. My profile is on there. You can also go to my Instagram, post a lot about my cases on there. And it is @FunkelSam_. And yeah, I think that's pretty much the only social media that I'm super active on right now. So,
got it. Funkel Sam. I love it. All right. Well, thank you again. And hopefully we can have you back on at some point, maybe some follow up and whatnot. But have a great, you know, rest of the day.
Okay. Thank you so much.
And that's a wrap on another episode of Cases for Causes, hosted by Obu Interactive. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our company, we can be reached at www.obuinteractive.com. That's obuinteractive.com. If you're interested in learning more about the show or even coming on as a guest, I can be reached directly at michael@obuinteractive.com. Thanks. We'll see you next time on Cases for Causes.